not a gigabyte, if you know what I mean. So is there a possibility of an incompatibility of formats that require reformatting in order to make everybody happy here? Give me some guesses on this one, Eric. K-E-Q-E-J, H-U-L-I-W.
Sorry, correct me if I'm wrong. Did you say 1.6 megabytes for 2 minutes?
We said that's a primitive for continuous 2 minute file is about 1.6 megabytes.
Alright, 1.6 megs. So there's 60 minutes in an hour by 2. Okay, so 1.6 megs times 30 per hour doesn't add up to a gigabyte. If the file was that large, I think Jerry broke it down into small little chunks like that for a couple of years. Most email boxes won't take more than 3 minutes. But, I don't know if Jerry has something with the whole file. I doubt it from what I'm hearing, but, you know, large files you would have to change. But that's not very large. And by the way, the size of the file probably changes based on the content. So, XORW.
Yeah, 1.6 megabytes per 2 minutes for a 4 hour check net is going to be 192 megabytes. I'm having trouble believing that what the mic number one downloads at amateurradio.tv is anywhere near that massive.
Oh, come on, that's small, Vic.
Yeah, but when you ask for one of those 1 hour reels from amateurradio.tv, to my system, and I don't have high-speed internet connection, it downloads to me in about 5 seconds, the whole 1 hour reel in about 5 seconds. And so that would be 50 megabytes. I don't think that my system would move that fast, if you know what I mean. So there must be another kind of compression or bit removal going on here. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Alright, let's ask Jay another question. What sample rate are you recording, Jay?
Good, I don't know. I have to go upstairs and take a look, so I'll get back to you in about 5 minutes. Alright, what you're probably getting, Dick, is downloads in 5 seconds. The download speed is, say, 10 or 15 megabytes a second. That is the book size of the file that you download. But if you have to expect to get it using a much higher sample rate, if you do it at, say, 8 bits instead of 16 bit wide, you do it at 8 kilohertz, you're doing all you need to do. So, let's see. Let's say 10 kilohertz per second. So, 10 kilohertz per second, there's 60 seconds in a minute, so that's 60 kilobits. It's not a heck of a lot, but some quality is less important. But there's lots of different formats, Dick. There's hundreds of them, actually, but we have to use what's available via the 10 windows. And there's also QuickTime, which can be in many, many, many different places. And there's actually MP2, MP3, MP4, which is doing a different form of expression. There's MP3, there's
Yeah, first of all, I said 5 seconds. I think it downloads in about 3 seconds. I have the cheapest possible internet connection from Fios. I'll be amazed if I've even got 2 megabytes of data rate on a good day.
Is that Fios, did you say?
That's a Roger, but I got the cheapest possible system.
Yeah, but check. Their cheapest one is 15 down, you know, 2 up. You know, if you really want to know what the speed is, it'll work on your Linux machine in your browser. Type speedtest.net, S-P-E-E-D.
at steve.nnt, and it'll tell you.
Okay. However, assume now that Jerry is sampling at a rather high data rate, bit rate, and he sends those files of that particular format to amateurradio.tv, the website, and it requires reconversion to his particular format. Is that procedure, from your point of view, Eric, usually difficult?
Most editing programs will do the conversion without even thinking about it.
Okay, so what you're telling me is that even if Jerry is using an extremely high bit rate, and if Mike is using a much lower bit rate of what he downloads to us, you're saying the compatibility between those two is almost not a problem, is what I think I'm hearing from you, Eric. Go ahead.
This is Jerry.
Okay, go ahead, Jerry.
This is Eric. Come to 16 bits. That's what sample rate? Sample rate is 16. 16 kilohertz? It says 16. No, I don't want to play with the options because it may destroy the recordings. No, when you select the recording message, it's just like the ribbon word. It's 8-bit, 16-bit, 24-bit. So that's why. And the other thing is the sample rate. Typical sample rate is 8 kilohertz, 12 kilohertz. 18 kilohertz, 26 kilohertz, 4 kilohertz. So, one of those is the one that's really interesting. I'll go up there and see which option that's under. I'll be back.
Okay.
That's funny. Obviously, he's using an audio editing program. He's, you know, listening through this stuff and putting out chunks and making labels and stuff like that. Most programs like Logic and Cakewalk or various other types of audio editing programs, Panasonic, Vegas, there's a lot of them out there. They will take whatever file format you feed in. At least with what you standard ones are. And we'll automatically sample and convert them to whatever format we happen to be wanting to output. So, in your case, maybe outputting 8 bits at 8 kilohertz, which is a very small file. And then as an input to his editing program, like coming in with 16 bits at 23 kilohertz, and it will automatically crunch it down through the standard format that he's working with on his output.
Those are very encouraging words, Eric. So that conversion from one format to the other sounds like it's not a big deal. To me, it would be, but
20 years or 15 years, it was a very big deal.
I hear you. So how recently did it become such an easy conversion, Eric? In the last year or two?
It's something that has evolved. Because there are so many different formats, but as more and more manufacturers or software development or individuals, actually there's a lot of GNU stuff, there's a lot of freeware out there that with the source code you'll see the development of different types of systems. You know, whatever the basic format is, whether it's a Windows Vista file, WSD or WMA, or a WAV file, which is a ton of compressed file. That's what everybody starts with. Once the compression starts to come along, then people start to write code that includes those compressions. They can do that, and if they're editing programs, that becomes another input format. Now, 12, 10, 15 years later, people doing it. Every format known to man, not every, but most of the formats that are used in the audio world are available and usable in their program.
Very fine. So this complicated world of computers is getting better, I can tell. Sounds good. I see if Jerry is back with his bit rate. The speaker said he commented. ZDX first, and then John next. After that, ZDX, are you back? C2LAW.
I got a bit rate here, 2LAW.
Okay, yeah. We're going to go to Jerry, John, and Anthony in that order. ZDX, are you back?
26, the information was already sent over to Mike.
Let's have that again then, John. KC2WGB, who sent the information to Mike already? In other words, are you saying the recordings that he's missing have already been sent to him? Is that what you're saying there? John, go ahead.
KC2GS has sent a copy of last week's TechNet over to Mike. So he has it. He'll post it when he gets a chance. So it's already taken care of.
Fantastic. Where did AC2GS get the recording from, my John?
No information on that, Dick. It's just a quick note there that it's already been taken care of.
How did you find out it's already been taken care of? Well done.
Via the chat room. He just typed it up and came up here, so I presented it.
That guy Roy is all right. For an Irishman, he's a good guy. That's a joke. Roy Lauper. He mails me some very nice emails from time to time. I wish Roy from Brooklyn had the right kind of equipment at his QTH so he could sign it directly electric. I'd love to hear his voice one of these days. Well done. Okay. Give that guy a gold star. So, as you can tell, John and everyone else listening, we're settling a lot of details now of data flow and data rate or formatting and whatever. But the original question, which I'm going to repeat in brief form, how does the three element Yagi work? I was starting to tell people that I went through this elaborate process by which I could really finally tune Yagi. And I carried that out in 1978. And from 1978 to 1984, during that 4 or 6 year period of time, a number of informed people thought that the highest gain Yagi on 432 in the world with confirmed gain measurement on a real antenna range was the so-called RIW-19. There were informed people who believed that, and whether that is true, you and I can argue about that. When it comes to a three-element Yagi, and I've spent the last 10 years of my life, from time to time, a portion of time, almost every single week, tuning three element Yagi. I'm about to say, why in the world would a person do that? Let me drop the And the answer is, on the front end of a modern day handheld radio frequency identification, interrogator, reader, call it what you like, the thing that reads the RFID tag, when it comes to a state of the art RFID reader that has 24 feet of range capability, when looking at a thoroughly passive RFID tag, the thing that's hanging on the front of that handheld device, the slightly homely looking clip, is a three-element Yagi. That three-element Yagi has a brand new patent on it that was issued somewhere around 2004, if I remember, 2005. Some crazy guy in Long Island reinvented the Yagi, and how in the world did the 1925 design of Indusuka Yagi get reinvented? And the answer is by making it out of sheet metal at 915 megs, by building it in a crazy way where the sheet metal is the equivalent of elements that are extremely wide with a slightly unique feeding technique that was also a patented idea by Kent Britton at E5BJB. You put that all together and you've got this extremely high performance, very simple looking, very inexpensive antenna, which is housed in a bunch of rubber, so that the whole thing can be dropped a couple of meters on the concrete floor and can be dropped 1,500 times and survive and keep on working. That was the criteria of the company that was building this thing. Thank you. So what is a three-element Yagi? Of course, it's got a dipole-like driven element. For a Yagi to work well, there's a zillion different ways you can make the driven element. There's nothing special about any of them. As long as the dipole radiates in a dipole-like manner, gives you a good impedance match to your transmission line, and the pole interface between transmission line and dipole, as long as it has the right kind of a balancing function, such that you launch the signal onto the dipole, and it doesn't relaunch current back onto the outside of the coax cable. That's what balance function does when it's set up correctly. So as long as you've got a dipole that radiates in a dipole-like manner and gives you those characteristics, you have the beginning of a very good Yagi. Jeff? And that three-element Yagi is now going to have two parasitic elements. They're called parasitic because there is no feed line going through them. There is a dipole-like structure in the case of a 915 meg Yagi, or about 2 inches out in front of the driven element, is a slightly shorter dipole-like structure with no feed line going through it, called director. And about 1 inch behind the driven element is a longer dipole-like structure with no feed line going through it, which is called reflector. Okay. Those passive elements, those passive things sitting there, do an awful lot of magic. And that was really the essence of Mr. Yagi's original design way back in 1925. Yagi, the professor that was running the experiment, so to speak, and it turns out that his student, Mr. Buda, did most of the work. Quite a few antenna people will call it a Yagi-Buda antenna or a Buda-Yagi antenna. Those are minor details. But the genius of that antenna is that when it's working correctly, it takes a minimum amount of aluminum. Drop. Okay, the minimum amount of aluminum, the minimum amount of weight, the minimum amount of wing load, the minimum amount of dollars, gives you a hell of a lot of performance. That three-element Yagi that I'm describing, where each of the elements are about 4 inches long, the whole antenna from the back is around 4 inches. It contains 20 cents worth of sheet metal, so to speak, and it gives you 6 decibels of gain. You put power into that antenna, and what gets radiated in a pattern coming out the front, that if you could see the pattern, gotta be careful now, but the usual way of plotting it, it would be a cucumber pattern with about 85 degrees of horizontal beamwidth and about 85 degrees of vertical beamwidth and 6 decibels of gain. 6 decibels gain is a 4-to-1 ratio. You put 1 watt into that antenna, the signal being radiated out the front of that antenna looks like 4 watts. It is 4 watts of effective radiated power. Now, yes. And how do those two parasitic elements do all that? Let me drop. A forward director being shorter than a resonant lens acts like a capacitor. It gives you a phase leading characteristic. Let me see if I put that right. It's actually phase lagging. So the director sitting out in front absorbs some of the energy coming off the dipole. It absorbs and re-radiates it. But it absorbs and re-radiates it with a phase shift such that the signal coming from the dipole going forward and the signal coming from the re-reflection, re-radiation from the director, those two signals going forward are in phase with each other, and they add. The reflector out back is doing the opposite. It's also absorbing some of the signal and re-radiating it, and it's re-radiating it out of phase. So the signal coming off the dipole that wants to go into the rear direction experiences some signal being absorbed and re-radiated by the reflector, and those two signals in the rearward direction are out of phase and cancel. So the reflector is tending to, cancel the signal that wants to go into the rearward direction. The director out front is enhancing the signal that wants to go in the forward direction. You put it all together, and then when it's properly tuned, the right spacing, the right length of those parasitic elements, and the right tuning of the driven element, you get 6 dB of gain over isotropic out of a 3-element Yagi. If you really did a very fine job of tuning it, you could get 6.5 dB of gain. In this particular application, the extra length of the boom that would be required to get the 6.5 dB of gain would require about another inch of length. And the manufacturer of this particular reader didn't want to spend the extra length. He wanted the antenna sitting out in front of the handheld device to be as compact as possible, therefore he insisted that not have that extra lens. And they sacrificed a 6.5 dB over isotropic of gain and it's reading of the running at 6 dB. Okay, those are minor details. Can I drop? That is the best way of analyzing what really happens with a three-element YAGI. If you've got a real good antenna range and you want to build your own super YAGI with 3 elements, 13 elements, 33 elements, or 133 elements. And by the way, there is a YAGI you can buy from K1WHS, Dave O'Reen of the, I can't think of the name of his company right now, Directive Systems in Lebanon, Maine. He can sell you a YAGI at 3.3 gigahertz, which has, I think, 130 elements, and they're all doing something good. So people in the old days used to think that a YAGI runs out of steam if you go beyond 13 elements. Well, by the criteria they were building YAGIs in those days, it was sort of true. People used to think that all the directors should be the same length and all the spacing should be the same length. Absolutely not. Yep.
It's a question, Nick, WS2N.
I'll get to your question in a minute, Paul. So, 3 elements, as just described, sort of what's happening with the 3 elements. As you start building gadgets of longer and longer boom length and more elements, and turns out that Dr. Hahn, PL6WU, Dr. Yagi, he has spent most of his lifetime studying Yagi antennas of everybody's design. Anybody who has ever built a Yagi that became recognized in any country in the world, he built a scale model of it at 4.32 megacycles and measured it in the great anechoic range and anechoic chamber that was available to him at the Research Institute of the German Federal Post Office in Darmstadt, Germany. He had that beautiful capability in his hip pocket, so to speak, and he could really tune and measure Yagi. So, he published a whole lot of articles, but the bottom line, as he discovered, is that as long as you've done a reasonably good job of tuning the directors, if you decide to build, let's say, for instance, a Yagi like my 19-element Yagi, which is 13 feet long, I mean, that's great. In my case of a Yagi that's 13 foot long, if you do a good job of putting the directors on there, you can probably put 13, 15, 17, 19 directors, if you know what I mean, and as long as they're well-tuned, you rapidly come to the conclusion that the length of the boom is the major determining factor of the gain of the Yagi, not necessarily the number of elements. If you're doing a good job of tuning the elements, and the length of the boom is the major criteria. As such, he has published an extremely well-accepted formula where he tells him the number of wavelengths of the boom, and on the assumption the Yagi is well-tuned, he can tell you with a very small amount of error exactly what gain that Yagi is capable of producing. Now, I was about to go and describe what happens when the Yagi is longer than 3 elements, like a 19-element Yagi. Are all of those 19 directors doing the same amount of phase cancellation of the forward and phase addition of the forward? What's really happening with the next 15 elements, so to speak? I was about to go into that description, but maybe Paul's got a question on what he's heard so far. WS2S, K2RY, definitely from the beach, you got a ball.
And before you get into multiple elements, going back to your 3-element director, dipole, and reflector. Let's say that the dipole was pushing a certain amount of wattage. We'll pick 10 watts. You could measure the 10 watts going into that dipole. If you could measure how many watts would be going into the director, or for that matter, going into the reflector. Just wondering, you know, how much of a drop is there, you know, if 10 going into the dipole, you know. Wonder what it would be going into the other one. And then let's say you moved it, you mistuned it, you moved it an inch forward or an inch back, you know, how much would it drop, you know. I just thought of it, I know if I look on the internet, it'll probably take me forever. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, if you've got the right kind of equipment on the right kind of an antenna range where you can resolve small changes in gain, and you start doing the tuning procedure, electronically or mechanically. You're changing the length of the sphincter, you're changing the length of the reflector, and you're changing the position. So, for the three-element Yagi, you've got one, two, three, four. You've got four variables to play with. Length of director, position of director. Length of reflector, position of reflector. And there's some interaction between the two. You can play with those parameters that are in your hand, in your control, and you will rapidly come to a conclusion that the length of the director and reflector is fairly critical. We've got a good design on 915 megs. You probably want to get those lengths to the nearest step, 16th of an inch, 3/32nds of an inch, in order to get a reproducible product. So length of parasitic element is quite critical. Position of parasitic element is not very critical. Once you've started off with a good design, if you take that director that's roughly 3 inches forward, and you move it 4 inches forward or 2.5 inches forward, fairly little change takes place. The position is only slightly sensitive. Length and diameter of element, very sensitive. As I've said many times, a Yagi is a weird combination of sensitive and not sensitive parameters when you're doing the tuning procedure. Now, when it comes to the amount of watts coming out of your dipole, 10 watts was your example, and you want to know how many watts is getting into the parasitic element, we get a little bit of a definition of terms here. Let me drop. And that is, of the 10 watts going into the driven element, you can easily confirm by conservation of energy and other kinds of measurements that 9.99 watts is being radiated in space. Almost none of it is being converted into heat if you've used reasonable materials to build a driven element and a driven element driving assembly. And if you've done a good job of piece smashing, almost none of that 10 watts is being reflected back to the transmitter as thin wave ratio. So the power goes down your feed line, transmission line, once, goes into the dipole, it's radiated in space, 10 watts goes in, 9.99 watts goes out into space, and so you know exactly how many watts is flowing in what direction, so to speak, on the driven element. Now when it comes to the parasitic element, to tell you how many watts is there becomes a problem, because there is no feed line by which you can measure it. It's running ice cold. It is absorbing some number of volts of E field and amps per meter of H field, and absorbing it and re-radiating it. I guess you could, if you want to, convert the director temporarily. You could put some kind of a feed line to it with some kind of a sampling network, and you could find out how many watts it is capable of absorbing in that environment. I don't know the answer, but I'm going to make a guess. I'm going to make a guess that 10 watts into the driven element gives you the capability of the director absorbing 3 of those watts. That's a pure guess on my part, and a similar number for the reflector. The exact number of watts is not what you pick up when you're doing the tuning procedure. You're doing a tuning procedure where you're observing the amount of power going in the forward direction. A real antenna range, let me drop, as the antenna runs test, a known amount of power is going into it. Some form of detector is out in front of the antenna in the far field range. In the case of a three-element Yagi at 915 megacycles, you go through the mathematics, you'll be amazed. The near field range is 3 feet. As long as your detector out in front of that Yagi at 915 megs, the three elements, is more than 3 feet away, it's in the far field. In the far field, whatever measurement you make is traceable to the bureau. Every antenna has got 3 ranges of interest: reactive near field, and far field. Near field is sometimes called the Fresnel zone. Far field is sometimes called the Von Hoffman zone, because these particular guys figured out what's going on. When you're in the far field, and if you're measuring the pattern of the antenna, while you're mounting the antenna under test on some kind of a pedestal where it can be rotated in azimuth and elevation, as long as your detector is in the far field, the pattern that you measure, 3 feet away, 33 feet away, or 3 miles away, will be the exact same antenna pattern. I didn't say the watts are the same. I'm saying the antenna pattern. How much power is radiated in that direction as you locate the antenna and azimuth elevation? As long as you're in the far field, and the calculated far field is 2D squared over lambda, you take the apparent diameter of the effective area of that antenna, square it, divide it by the wavelength, and gives you some number of feet or some number of meters of calculated near field range for that antenna. As long as your sensing equipment is outside of that range, the pattern that you measure will be the gospel. It'll be the true pattern. If you make the mistake of putting your sensing equipment too close to the edge, so that you're in the near field or inside the reactive near field, you'll get a pattern. Good job. The pattern will differ tremendously. The bell between the main lobe and the first side lobe will start disappearing. The side lobe will be the wrong amplitude. The front-to-back ratio will be the wrong number. The current gain will be the wrong number. You make measurements in the near field. Unless you apply a whole lot of rather sophisticated compensating formulas, the near field measurements will at first lie to you. So if you're setting up an antenna range, be sure it's in the far field. So I don't have it answered your question directly yet, Paul, but I'm giving you a little bit more information. That number of apparent watts is going into the director, is going into the reflector, because they are tuned high or low of the desired frequency, of the center frequency. They create a phase shift of the signal that they radiate. And it's that phase shift of the signal they radiate that gives you the directivity. You could, if you want to, let me drop. You could, if you want to, make a Yagi-like structure where there is a transmission line going to the driven element, a transmission line going to the director, and a transmission line going to the reflector. And you feed the right amplitude of signal to all three of those elements with the right phase shift of all of those three elements. That would be an all-driven phased array, what's called an end-fire structure. And it would give you gain a tiny bit larger than this example of 6.5 dB of gain over isotropic. Maybe you could get 7 or 7.5 dB of gain in that manner. But it would be a hell of a lot more complicated structure to have three separate feed lines, three separate amplitude adjusting devices, and three separate phase shifting devices. And all of that extra work would give you a very small amount of improvement for a three-element Yagi. Start getting into longer and longer Yagi, the amount of effort you have to put into that approach grows exponentially. The amount of improvement in performance you would get decreases and it becomes more and more of a law of diminishing return. So the magic of the Yagi is it's such a simple structure once you understand the theory of operation, once you're smart enough to use the right kind of materials that are low in loss that you build it out of. And as long as you have the right kind of a mounting structure for those elements, so that they're not breaking contact with the boom where the aluminum oxide buildup changes the cooling of it a year downrange, if you know what I mean. As long as you've done the right things, it's a very simple structure that gives you a lot of bang for the dollar. So a three-element Yagi and the phase shifting you get and the enhancement of the forward signal being co-phase and the cancellation of signal being anti-phase going aft, that gives you pretty much operation of a three-element Yagi. In the case of a very long Yagi, a hell of a lot of other things start taking place. In the case of a 19-element Yagi, where my crazy 19-element Yagi has two reflectors, not one, it's one of the uniqueness of that crazy design, and it's got 16 directors up there, if I can correct it. 16 directors, 16 directors, two reflectors, one driven element. What are those 16 directors doing? Are they all simultaneously adding the phase in the forward direction and canceling it in the rearward direction? Well, you could try to analyze it that way. People have tried to analyze a long Yagi as a kind of a very elaborate filter network. I mean, in the case of a 16-pole filter, where you've got 16 resonators all connected together with the right kind of a coupling coefficient between them, between the input connector and the output connector of your filter, each individual pole is absorbing a certain amount of energy, radiating, doing phase shifting, and filter procedure explains how a 16-element filter works. Try applying that philosophy to a 16-element, 16-director gadget, and you come up with mathematics that's crazy. There's something else going on. What you'll soon realize is that my Huygens principle, what's really going on, is that each of those directors on a long gadget is tuned below the desired center frequency. As such, to the waves coming in, they are a capacitively loading slow wave structure. That's a fancy way of saying that the signal that's flowing down the boom is a little bit more slowed down than the signal that's a little bit further away from the boom on that long gadget. Once you slow down the wave near the boom compared to the signal that's further away from the boom, you realize that this beautiful planar wavefront that you're receiving from a signal that's a mile away, so to speak, the signal emitted a mile away, by the time it gets to you, started off as a spherical bubble, but by the time it gets to you, that bubble is so flat, you can consider it a planar wavefront. The planar wavefront comes into the forward directors of your long yagi and starts taking on a concave phase front from the viewpoint of the driven element. Starts taking a concave phase front. The concave phase front means that because of Huygens' principle, where the individual pixels, so to speak, of the phase front are re-radiating a signal, and the re-radiating signal must always be re-radiated. We drop. Must be re-radiated at an angle that is perpendicular to the phase front. So you can see how a concave phase front gives you a focusing phenomenon, very similar to what happens with your magnifying glass. That magnifying glass that you use for focusing the sun onto a piece of newspaper and burning a hole in it is also doing the same thing. Most people will go to a class that teaches them optics, and they talk about the refractive index of the glass. That's one method of explaining it. To an antenna person, there is a better method of explaining it. The light wave flowing through your magnifying glass, the portions of it that go through the glass in the center, the glass is thicker and the signal is slowed down more. Light going through glass propagates more slowly than it does in free space. Because your magnifying glass is thicker in the center, the signal going through the center of your magnifying glass is more delayed than the amount of light flowing through the perimeter of your magnifying glass. Therefore, after this beautiful phase front coming from the sun goes into your magnifying glass, what comes out of your magnifying glass has a concave phase front from the viewpoint of the focal point. Therefore, that wave comes down to a focal point, gives you all of that solar energy collected by your magnifying glass down to maybe a 1/16 of an inch diameter, and that you should be wearing dark glasses when you do this experiment. You'll notice that your eyes start acting kind of funny. But now the concentration of sunlight will burn a hole and maybe even start fire. The long structure of all of those directors in a long yet is doing the exact same thing. It's creating a concave phase front towards the driven element. Therefore, what's really happening with a long yagi is that when you tune all those directors correctly, you left in position, we drop. All of that energy gathered by that director string gets focused down to the driven element, which absorbs it, sends it down to your feed line, sends it down to your receiver, and hopefully it takes the signal transmitter. The magic of this delay function, Huygens' principal function of a long yagi, is that in the case of the yagi that I'm familiar with, 19-element yagi, 432 megacycles, about a 13-foot-long boom, and each of the directors are a little bit less than 12 inches long. That antenna, when it's tuned correctly and working correctly, is gathering energy from a 5.5-foot diameter of space. There's a round hole in space, 5.5-foot diameter, of the signal coming down in front of that yagi when it's aimed at that signal, and it's got the right polarization. You get the yagi horizontal with all the elements parallel to the ground, it's looking for a horizontally polarized signal. If a horizontally polarized signal is coming into the front of that yagi, And if your eyes operated at that frequency, you're standing in front of the edge and looking at it, you would see a black hole in space, 5.5 feet diameter. All the energy entering that area of space gets focused down to the driven element. The magic of that is that how in the world can individual directors that are only a foot long, a little bit less than a foot long, gather energy from 5.5 foot diameter of space? And this is where one of the sub-corollaries of Huygens principle takes place. Can you drop? In the beginning of that signal getting to the forward directors of that Yagi, you've taken roughly 1 foot diameter of space and started to focus it, and you started to delay it. Mother Nature doesn't like a discontinuity. The nearby phase front, so to speak, senses the fact that some of the signal near the boom has been delayed, and therefore the signal nearby starts folding into that space. The net result is that when you get the whole director stream tuned correctly, 5.5 foot diameter of space slowly gets all folded in and focused toward that driven element. But what must you do to that director stream to make all that magic happen? Each of those directors out in front, the 16 directors, are not all the same length. They're not all the same spacing. That's the mistake that people used to naively do when they were tuning long Yagis. They assumed that some magic director length would give it director performance. They assumed that some magic spacing between directors would make it work right. So they started building Yagis with constant spacings and constant lengths. They soon represented, they soon believed that a long Yagi runs out of steam. When I was starting to tune Yagis in 1972, and the Bill Orr, K1HJQ, what's the name of the guy who first started the World Above 50 Megacycles article in QST Magazine? My goodness. All of a sudden I can't think of his name. Somebody's going to tell me. Ed Tilton, W1HDQ, was the genius who started something called the World Above 50 Megacycles column in QST. Very popular for progressive guys at that age. However, the articles he was getting, the people who were doing backyard experiments, they were all beginning to believe that anything beyond 13 elements, and Ed Tilton had come out with a 13 element, Ed Tilton Yagi, and everyone beginning to believe that anything beyond 13 elements, the Yagi procedure runs out of steam and don't bother building it longer. By way of the concepts by which people were building Yagis in those days, it was sort of true, but it wasn't really. So once you've got the right kind of procedure, where you can really resolve small amounts of gain differences, and you do a proper job of tuning all those directors, and now you plot director length versus position. You make a graph where the horizontal axis is director number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so to speak, and the vertical axis is how long is that director, and you look at that graph, and you realize the graph has got a little bit of a Coke bottle shape to it. You would think that all the directors get smaller and smaller as you go out forward, away from the driven element. That's sort of true, but not completely true. A master from Yagi has got sort of a Coke bottle shape to it. You assume all the spacings are linear. Not necessarily true. When you get it just right, all the directors the right length and the right position, you've now come up with a slow wave structure that has what's called a particular velocity profile. The signal flowing down the boom gets slowed down a certain amount by each one of those directors. The amount gets slowed down is a function of how long is that director and what is the spacing to it between it and the adjacent director. You can now plot how much slow wave structure, how much slowing down of the signal, that's the vertical axis of the graph, and the horizontal axis is positioned along the boom. When you get an optimum tune, yes, there's a very characteristic curve of slow wave versus position. That graph is called velocity profile. When you've got the right velocity profile for your Yagi, you get maximum focusing by Huygens principle, In my case, a 5.5 foot diameter space, while the signal in that space gets focused down to the driven element, and out comes almost 16 decibels of gain over a isotropic. It's almost 16 over dipole, I think. Anyhow, 16, by the way, is a ratio of 40 to 1. In other words, the signal being radiated by that Yagi, when you stand in front of it, looks like 40 watts is coming out of the antenna, even though you've only put 1 watt into it. 16 decibels of gain is a 40 to 1 ratio. Very desirable characteristic. Now, once you've got this optimum Yagi, as I thought at the time, and you build 16 of them, and you mount them in a great big bed spring, like you can see on the picture that's on that website called TechNet, LimonTechNet.com. You go to that website, you'll see a picture of me standing in front of this 3,500 cubic foot antenna. It's just a 16 Yagi. Each one of them is the 5.5 foot spacing horizontally and vertically, the 13 foot long bulb, and the 15.5 foot of horizontal distance, 15.5 feet of vertical distance, is that total array. You mount that on top of 100 feet of tower, about 50 kilowatts into it at 432, and you think your line of sight is 40 miles away, and you start talking to a guy who's reasonably well equipped, 480 miles away on sideband, and you say, wow, how in the world is that signal getting there?
Repeater, time out.
Now, is a long Yagi really operating by a refractive optics, a particular velocity profile, magnifying glass phenomenon? Is the short Yagi really operating by interferometry of signals being edited in one direction and canceled in the other direction? Absolutely. And so, could you use one of the philosophies on the, could you use the short antenna philosophy on the long Yagi and the long Yagi philosophy on the short antenna? You could, but the analysis seems to make less sense. So, are the two different phenomena going on here? Not necessarily. They're really the same phenomena, different ways of looking at it. A little bit similar to when you start determining the Q of a tuned network. You've got an inductor and a capacitor, and there really is some built-in resistance there, whether you want it or not. The resistance is usually in series with the inductor. No matter where the resistance is, every inductor and capacitor you put together as a tuning network has a parameter called Q, quality factor. Now, John?
Good question. Did you do a couple of questions?
We're going to get to Barry and John and then Glenn in that order. The Q of that network, you can define the Q as bandwidth divided into center frequency. You can define the Q as rise time and fall time. You can define the Q as energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. You can define it as a phase shift or whatever. There's four or five different, voltage rise at resonance and current rise at resonance. There's five different ways you can define the Q of an LC network. Are there five different Qs? Absolutely not. There's just five different ways of making the measurement. They all have the exact same Q. So the directors out in front have a certain amount of Q as a function of what is their internal resistance, how much are they loaded by the nearby elements. So, and is a long Yagi a focusing magnifying glass? Yes. Is a short Yagi an interferometry network? Yes. That's the best way of looking at it to get human understanding. But in both cases, there's a little bit more going on. Let's see, Barry first, and two moons out. You've used a lot of Yagis for a lot of years. And by the way, let me give you something that I should have told you last week, Barry. You've done a fair amount of moon bouncing today. Remember that puzzle I gave you guys last week. Let me drop it. The puzzle I gave you was how big a rocket on the moon will accelerate the moon such that it moves down 1.5 inches per year, just like it does right now with the tides. It turns out that, Barry, that whenever the sun aims a signal at the Earth, yes, you're getting a certain amount of solar wind particles. You could, in theory, put up a solar sail with a spacecraft out in space, and you can get some thrust out of sunlight. Turns out there really is a radiation pressure of any electromagnetic wave. Although the amount of electromagnetic pressure you created was infinitesimally small, still, you by way of aiming high gain antennas with a lot of kilowatts of power going into them at the moon while you were doing moon dance, you were creating lunar pressure by the radio waves you were sending at the moon. You weren't going in the right direction, so to speak, but you were applying pressure to the moon from your backyard in the far Rockaway. I bet you never considered it that way, Barry. And to moon dance, keep your eyes up in the deck then.
Before you pick it up, Barry, Dick.
I was thinking of taking off possibly two elements because this thing is breaking up my rotator quite a bit. And I really don't want to fight with that. It's not necessary. I don't need it. So I may take an element or two off. How will that affect spacing and the tuning of the other elements? My best guess is it'll have very little effect on it, but I think you'll tell me that. And the other thing I was going to comment, because apropos of what you were just saying, when I'm aiming my antenna at the moon, and I'm transmitting multi-kilowatts at the moon and all that stuff, you're telling me that my radio signal is putting some pressure on the moon. I was taught to believe for every action is equal and opposite reaction, but I don't think that's true in the case of radio. Will you straighten me out on that? K2RW and 2MB in the book.
Dick, I quoted them.
Yeah, Barry, there is action and reaction. When you're transmitting that signal at the moon from your 28-foot dish in your backyard, for instance, the pressure that you're applying to the moon by that electromagnetic wave, which is very small, but it's there, and the amount of back pressure you're creating on the Earth, that antenna, when you transmit a kilowatt of signal into that antenna, you aim it at the moon, there is a slight difference in the pressure of that antenna being pushed onto the soil in Far Rockaway. Action and reaction. Very similar to what happens when you fire a gun. You fire a gun, the bullet, which is a light object, goes forward at high velocity, and the shoulder of the gun itself gives you a kickback, and the shoulder experiences that pressure. Action and reaction. There is always action and reaction. In other words, Newton's third law, there is no exception to it. So that the little tiny bit of pressure you apply to the moon did experience a little bit of tiny extra pressure on the Earth in Far Rockaway when you did that. That's one. That's the second answer to your question. Good job. But now, in the case of I'm not quite sure if you're talking about the 19 element Yagi, and maybe you are. The 19 element Yagi is really
about a 6 meter beam, and I think it's about 9 elements or 10 elements, something like that.
Okay, there are a zillion Yagi designs. If I decide that I want a 6-element Yagi on 6 meters, there's 10 different designs I can choose. Some of those designs are very forgiving, some of them are not. The main advantage of the Gunter Hawk design is that he's discovered that when you use his particular design procedure, which is a tiny bit below optimum gain, but it's a more forgiving design. You can take his 16-element Yagi, for instance, and decide to remove 2 elements, and the amount of gain decrease you get will be exactly equivalent to what's happening by the change at the length of the boom. You tell him how many wavelengths long is the boom, you plug it into the Gunter Hawk formula, he'll tell you exactly how much gain you're going to get. And his design is very forgiving, because as you remove elements from the forward, most forward director, the design will come down to the lower gain exactly the way it's supposed to, with a very small variation to it. There are other more exotic designs of the Yagi where they become a lot more critical. But as you start removing elements, the gain decrease you get is a hell of a lot more drastic. So is your particular 6 or 8 element, 6 meter beam, the drastic design or the forgiving design? The chances are very high it's a forgiving design. But know there is that one particular pitfall there, Barry. There's a slim chance it could be one of the less forgiving designs. and by giving you a little bit more research as to where your design came from, in theory you can find that out. Particularly if you take the design and compare it to the Sumter Hunt equivalent design, you'll know real fast, is it a forgiving design. And two moonbounds, K2LAW.
Okay. I could also call the manufacturer. I think he's in California. I can't remember the name of the manufacturer right now, because I haven't looked at the antenna in a long time. But that's good information. And that means that it's possible for you to do it. KYW into MV, Rocky Way.
It turns out that you can call the manufacturer and ask him if it's a forgiving design. And if it was a picture phone, you're doing it with him, and you could see the expression on his face, you would get the deer in the headlight expression on his face, Barry. The reason for that is twofold. The guy who manufactures the antenna doesn't know. The guy who designed the antenna for him is long gone. Most antenna manufacturers receive the design of what they're building from some mysterious person who's no longer there, and therefore you can ask them all these crazy questions. They'll give you an answer, but it's not based on reality. I'll bet you there's a high probability, and that's an antenna that's more than a year old, the guy who designed it for them ain't there at the factory anymore, and he may have even retired, he may have even become a silent king by now. Over to you, Barry. Thank you, Barry.
Okay, I remember it's an M square antenna. And I think they're making California. I really don't remember. But I'll call them tomorrow. Try to get an answer. What can I tell you? And QMD.
Yeah, each time I pass it over to you, Barry, you do not wait for the beep. We're lucky we're not to pass it out in that procedure. M squared is Mike Stahl, K6.
M-Y-6.
Yep. Now, he quite possibly is the designer. He is a real Yagi tuner. For quite a period of time, he used to have a veranda or a balcony on the second floor of his house. I can't remember the name of the town in California where he lived, where he was using that as a test procedure, as a place for mounting the antenna of the test. I'm not sure, though, he was really carrying out all of the procedure of the Dick Turin technique, W2IMU. Wrote a beautiful antenna tuning technique and testing technique, which is in the VHF handbook. There's also an issue of QST magazine. But the bottom line is that if the source antenna doing the transmitting for your antenna range is very close to the ground, and there's a very desirable procedure for setting up an antenna range where the ground reflection, you're not fighting it, it's in your favor, as opposed to what people used to do, try to make the transmitting antenna on one building, receiving antenna on another building, and because those two sites are high up and far away from the ground, they wanted to believe that ground reflection was negated. Well, rather than fight ground reflection, you're much better off using it in your favor. Was Mike Stahl doing it that way? I'm not sure. I do know that Mike Stahl, with his log periodic cell Yagi, 16 element Yagi, let me drop it. That particular design, which was in Ham Radio Magazine around 1968, and everyone wanted to believe that that was a be-all, end-all antenna, because it was a Yagi as far as the parasitic elements are concerned, because the driven element assembly of four individual dipoles set up as a log periodic was supposed to give you greater bandwidth. Therefore, he thought that by combining the two, he had maximum gain and maximum bandwidth in one Yagi. On paper, it sounded good. You looked at it with your eye, it looked good. When you actually went on range and took a Yagi that should be in the pick of number 10 megacycles of bandwidth, that so-called log periodic Yagi was only 2 megahertz wide. It was a hell of a lot more narrow than anybody else's Yagi, and it had this nasty vulnerability of those 4 driven element assemblies with the crisscross pieces of aluminum in between, all built up aluminum oxide. So that antenna, which is supposed to have 16 dB of gain, very rapidly went to much lower numbers because of the aluminum oxide on those driven elements. So it wasn't a great design in some people's minds. So I know that Glenn wants to ask some questions only about KC2QIQ, K2LAW. Very Glenn.
Let me
good evening, Dick. It's always a pleasure to hear you on. And just a couple of questions here about high Q, warm boom, high Q, and I guess the question that's always sat in the back of my mind is that when you look at these velocity profiles and they lay out the element structure along the boom, that when the frequencies change, I would assume that the scaling to frequency is going to be similar. In other words, if you were designing at, like, say,